Welcome to the Activation Podcast, brought to you by the Conscious Resistance Network. I'm your host, Derek Bros. In every episode of this podcast, we're going to explore solutions in the areas of health, permaculture, growing your own food, technology. We'll be interviewing guests who are providing important solutions that are more important than ever in this time we are living in. The Activation Podcast is focused on bringing you cutting-edge solutions to empower humanity. Hey everyone, this is Derek Bros, and you're listening to another episode of the Activation Podcast. This week, we're going to have a very interesting conversation. I find this conversation particularly to be maybe necessary, but definitely an important conversation following up my previous episode. For those of you who heard my episode with Catherine Austin Fitz, I think we called it Surviving Spiritual and Economic Warfare, and we covered a whole range of topics with Catherine. It was a really great conversation. If you haven't heard that one, I definitely recommend you listen to that after this conversation, because they're going to go hand in hand. And one of the things that we talked about, the bigger topics that I talked about with Catherine, was blockchain, crypto, the positive use cases of this as I see them, and even Catherine acknowledging some of them, and some of the worrisome use cases that we are starting to see around the world. And for those of you who follow me on social media, you might be aware there's been some brouhaha online about some of the things said in that interview. And ultimately, I think it's just been adding to this conversation, which is important. What role is crypto and blockchain and digital technology, the internet, the metaverse, all these ideas, what role are they going to play in the future of a free humanity? Will humanity be able to stay free with some of these technologies? Will we be able to keep them free and voluntary and consensual and decentralized and open source? Or will they become used for tyrannical purposes? I think this is something that is very much on the minds of my listeners and my followers. And I want to dive deeper into that conversation with an old friend of mine, Sterling Lujan. How are you doing today, brother?
Man, I'm doing well. Thanks for having me, Derek. I think this is going to be a very fruitful discussion, to say the least.
Yeah, I agree. So before we get into everything today, man, I just was looking at my website. The last time we had a conversation, you know, recorded conversation, interview like this, of course, we've seen each other many times since this, but this was July 2016, which I think was around the time we were first really connecting. And again, I'm going to invite everybody to check out this interview. It will be in the show notes, because that interview is much different than what we're going to focus on today, because it was really when you were coming on to the libertarian, you know, anarchist scene with your message of psychological anarchism and compassionate anarchism, relational anarchism, which really, you know, molded well with what some of the things I was talking about. And it was a great time, great conversation, but I can't believe it's been that long since right. We actually recorded another talk. But why don't you go ahead and tell everybody a little bit about, you know, yourself, whatever you want to share, what you're up to these days, and anything you think that might be relevant for the topics we're going to get into today.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been working in the cryptocurrency industry for about 6 years. So I'm what you would call a quote unquote insider. But I didn't come into the space from a background of high finance or any type of securitization or background in those regards. So I got into the cryptocurrency space from my experience of being embedded in libertarian and anarchist communities. Through those communities, I learned about crypto anarchism very early on from the likes of people like Timothy May and all of their writings and their material. And through this process, I got online, I got into hearing about Bitcoin back in 2013, 2014. And as a result of that early exposure to cryptocurrency and Bitcoin, I really started screaming at the top of my lungs about the importance of this technology and how it's going to be transformative, not only in my personal life, but for society as a whole, and that it could possibly engender a paradigm shift sooner rather than later. So this is really how I got into the space. Of course, prior to that, I'll just provide a little bit of a tidbit because this is a long story. I got into thinking about libertarianism, anti-statism, from my experiences directly with the state. So I was arrested in 2009 for possession of MDMA. And after I got arrested, I really realized how corrupt and broken the system was. And this woke me up to this idea that I'm not the guilty party here. I was just engaging in free market enterprise, right? If I'm trading drugs with someone else, that is a voluntary interaction. And that those ideas really colored my perspective. And I started reading people like Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, Ludwig von Mises, And I even read some of the left anarchists who are relevant or quasi left anarchists like Carl Hess, Peter Kropotkin, and those folks. And so I woke up and I came to be really who I am today. And ever since then, I've been working in the space, and that's for about 6 years now. I worked with Bitcoin.com for 3 years and directly with Roger Ver. And then when I left Bitcoin.com, I started working for a company called CryptoSpace. CryptoSpace is a cryptocurrency exchange and trading desk, and also a cryptocurrency custodianless platform. At least it's about to be, because we're about to launch the platform. But I do the risk management and the banking relationships with CryptoSpace. So that's where we're at right now, and that's where I'm at personally.
One of the big topics we're going to talk about today is, of course, blockchain and crypto, because as you just outlined, you have a lot of experience in that. Most of my listeners will know I've been getting paid in crypto since 2012 for my journalism, for my writing. And so I've been in and around the edges of the space, reporting on it, just about as long as you were, closer on the inside. And there's going to be some in the audience who have a very full understanding of crypto, you know, very crypto savvy, holding crypto, using, maybe even involved in blockchain projects and some of these things. But there's also going to be folks who I think don't quite yet even have an understanding of what blockchain and crypto are. So although this is very 101 beginner stuff, I would like you, if you can, before we even get into this and start losing some people, to just start there. Like, in the simplest terms you can, explain blockchain to somebody who has no idea what a blockchain is and how cryptocurrency relates to that.
Gotcha. I think so. The best way to start is most everyone has a bank account, right? When you use your bank, when you deposit money into your bank, that's not that at that point, it's not physical anymore, right? It's not like a dollar that you hold in your hand. Banks use a ledger to maintain accounts, deposits, and credits. So cryptocurrency or Bitcoin is a distributed ledger or a decentralized ledger. All this means is that there's a number of computers spread across the globe that maintain a ledger, right? So when you send or receive cryptocurrency like Bitcoin, this ledger is updated, right? And we're able to keep track of that simply by looking on the what's called the blockchain, which is the vertebrae of cryptocurrency. And this is, without getting too complex, this is how it works, right? Every time somebody does a transaction, one of these computers on this network called miners picks up this transaction and they package it into this block as a piece of data. These blocks, let's just say these blocks hold 1 megabyte of data, which is typical of Bitcoin, a little bit more with segregated witness. When these blocks fill up, the miners create a new block. And once they create a new block, they print some new cryptocurrency, some new Bitcoin. And this works because miners are effectively in a race to solve a complex mathematical puzzle. And whoever wins gets to create the new block and they get a cryptocurrency or a Bitcoin reward. And on and on and on and on and on it goes ad infinitum. So cryptocurrency is this vast, decentralized, distributed network that is extremely safe, extremely fault tolerant, and does not have a single point of failure. For instance, with the banks, somebody could steal some information from the bank or steal funds from the bank, hack into the bank and gain access to data. And that's very difficult to retrieve. And that actually has happened, whereas that's impossible to happen on the Bitcoin protocol, at least with current technology. It's impossible to hack into the Bitcoin protocol and break it on a fundamental level. Because say if you hacked into one computer on the Bitcoin network and you destroyed that computer, well, that computer is just erased, right, as a node on the network. And all of the other computers on the network are still running the same protocol and they take over all of the bandwidth effectively. So it's very difficult and very challenging for people to break the Bitcoin or cryptocurrency protocol. And I just want to be clear, I'm using Bitcoin as the example because it's really the cryptocurrency. It's the first one that ever was created, but that's the basics of it. It's a distributed, decentralized network that not only is a payment network, but also contains actual coins, right? It has money that is attached to the payment network that we can send and move around. That's very difficult for hackers or malicious actors to attack. So I hope that's helpful.
And we should, of course, make it clear that, and I think you were kind of hinting at this, that just because you're using Bitcoin as an example, Bitcoin is not the only cryptocurrency, nor is it the only blockchain. Because I think that's the other thing that I've noticed with some people who are unfamiliar with technology is they use the term blockchain as like a monolithic thing. Like it's just one thing. There's only, you know, just this one blockchain. Could you talk a little bit more about that? Just, you know, you don't have to really get all into the altcoins too much, but just the idea of blockchain as a tool that can be used and is being used for not only different cryptocurrencies, but for different types of projects.
Yeah, absolutely. So the beautiful thing about blockchain technology is that it can engender or facilitate other types of technologies. So what some people have said is that currency or money is just one possible app on a blockchain. But there are other potential applications for blockchain technology that make it useful as an underlying tech, right? And just to give you an example, the primary example, it would be the Ethereum blockchain. Ethereum is effectively a vast computer system or network of computers that allows people to build applications on top of it. These applications have been called dApps. So what these have enabled is for people to create their own companies, their own decentralized companies, or their own dApps that perform certain kind of functions on a blockchain. And this gives rise to new types of organizations called decentralized autonomous organizations. It gives rise to non-fungible tokens or creating tokens that aren't fungible. In other words, you can't trade one for another. A good example of that is artwork or novels or any kind of book or any piece of art for that matter. So blockchain technology has facilitated a ton of different use cases, right? Or value propositions. And money is only one of the primary use cases. And that's what Bitcoin facilitated very early on. But as you can see, blockchain enables all types of different usability, which is really amazing and beautiful. And we're only just now starting to see all the myriad of possibilities of technological enablement facilitated by blockchain technology.
I want to make one other thing clear before we start getting into, I definitely want to talk about DAOs and to start getting into first some of the exciting things about crypto and blockchain. And for those who really do not like crypto, yes, we'll be getting to some of the concerns as well. But I want to make one statement that you said clear, which was a true statement. You said that the network is unhackable, but I know there's going to be some people who hear that and they're going to remember that they saw a story about an exchange being hacked or somebody lost their crypto. Maybe just, you know, kind of flesh that point out a little bit, that while the system and the kind of distributed network is unhackable, as you said, that doesn't mean that there aren't ways that people's crypto have been hacked.
Yeah, Derek, and I want to be really clear. There's going to be a lot to unpack when we start talking about this technology, cryptocurrency, blockchain. There's a lot of different components. There's a lot of peripheral discussions. So there's going to be some things that I do gloss over. So I'm glad that you're pointing me in the direction of certain items that we can talk about. Yeah. So here's the thing. The Bitcoin protocol in itself is unhackable because it is based on a network protocol, consensus mechanisms. However, what people have heard often is that they've had their Bitcoin hacked and they've lost millions of dollars or thousands of dollars. So this is because with cryptocurrency, we have a choice. We can either hold our own cryptocurrency, which just means that we can self-custody our own funds using wallets that are typically software and that look into the blockchain to gain access to your funds. However, what a lot of people have a tendency to do, and I think this is primarily because of what we're used to doing, we allow other entities or other organizations to custody our funds for us, right? So exchanges like Coinbase, Poloniex, Kraken, Bittrex, Binance, a whole number of popular exchanges are what we call centralized. So what happens is that people move their funds over to these exchanges, or they purchase cryptocurrency with their fiat currency on these exchanges as a payment rail, and then they hold their currency on these exchanges. Well, that's extremely risky because an exchange is still on a layer of the internet that is hackable, right? It's just like somebody hacking into your computer personally and gaining access to your passwords. So if someone hacks into these exchanges and they gain access to the passwords, to the keys on those exchanges, then they can start stealing funds. And traditionally, these exchanges are what we refer to in the space as honeypots, right? They collect a tremendous amount of value, and it makes them a prime target for malicious and bad actors. And that's why the Silk Road is sort of the eponymous case of cryptocurrency theft, because it was one of the first exchanges. And as a lot of you may have heard, millions of dollars, billions of dollars were stolen from that exchange from a hacking attempt, right? There's some other reasons why that may have happened, but that's neither here nor there. I wanted to make one other point. It's also possible for people to hack into individual computers and gain access to people's private keys and steal their funds. But this is different because it's stealing from an individual by gaining access to, it's just like gaining access to a password. Like you have your Facebook password or your bank account password. Someone gains access to that, they're going to get your funds. If they gained access to the bank, to your banking password, that doesn't mean they gained access to the bank itself and its vaults, right? They gained access to that one particular account. And that's the case with cryptocurrencies. You can't gain access to the blockchain. It's impossible. There have been hackers who have tried to gain access to the blockchain protocol, especially on Bitcoin, and it's failed. But a lot of people have been hacked, a lot of exchanges have been hacked, and these individuals have lost a lot of money. So security and privacy is the onus of the individual. The individual has to take personal responsibility to guard their keys, make sure they're practicing safe practices of cryptocurrency storage by using hardware wallets, by leveraging two-factor authentication, by making sure they don't fall victim to a SIM swap. So there's a whole, the whole discussion of privacy and security is super long, and it requires not only a discussion of cryptocurrency and encryption protocols, but also of the greater idea of how do we protect ourselves from not leaving our digital footprint lying around for everybody to gain access to. So this is a huge discussion, but ultimately it boils down to the Bitcoin protocol is one of the strongest technologically safe protocols that we've ever created, but there are still pitfalls primarily involved in user error. So I'm pretty sure that clears up that concept.
Yeah, no, great explanation there. And I really want to also kind of second what you were saying there about personal responsibility. I think that's one of the first things that I really recognized when I started to get into crypto, from just holding it and wallets and then also trying to make sales or exchanges and maybe doing it in a hurry and doing it with untrustworthy people on different exchanges and then getting money, not having a successful transaction, let's say, different things like that. But ultimately the responsibility fell on me, right? There was no anybody to call or complain to because I'm the one that did the transaction. And the only person that I can really blame was I didn't take enough time to do better, on my part. And so I think that's important for people to understand. I think that can be intimidating for some people because they do, even if they don't like the banks handle all the legwork for them. They just got to deposit money. But I think it is just part of becoming a more free person. If you are interested in crypto and blockchain and learning these tools, they are tools that can be useful and can provide value in different ways. I want to talk about the crypto space as a whole for a minute, Sterling. I mean, like I said, I started to report on different crypto conferences in 2013, 2014, Texas Bitcoin Conference, a few others in and around the U.S., and just interviewing people, trying to understand it. I interviewed Vitalik back in like 2015, something like that. I think I can't even remember. I was really early on, maybe 2014. And I noticed right away that there were definitely people within the crypto space who were more of the mindset of people like you and I. I definitely had, and I say had because I don't know if I still hold this anymore, but a very optimistic, maybe naively optimistic vision of how crypto and blockchain could revolutionize things and make banks and governments, a thing of the past. And part of me still hopes for that, but I feel like I started to see over time that space get more co-opted. And I mean co-opted from people who are like just different philosophically, who think regulation is the answer. We need the government involved, et cetera. That'll make things legitimate and the space will be better. To people who might even have some nefarious visions, from my perspective, to use this technology, right? And it's just, it seems like the crypto anarchist crowd has shrank, or maybe it's still the same amount of people, but the other side has grown. And I think a lot of it has to do with the growth of the crypto space, the money. I know personally people reach out to me saying, hey, can you help me get some Bitcoin? They don't know anything about it. They don't care about privacy. They don't care about any of these things. They just want to make money. And that's all they've heard. And they'd go through mainstream means to acquire their crypto. So yeah, talk a little bit about that though. Like, what has been your perspective and your experience in attending events and speaking at events and working at for crypto companies? Do you still feel like that anarchist spirit is alive in the crypto space?
Yeah, that's an interesting conversation. I don't think that the spirit is as strong as it used to be per se, but this is not something that I did not expect to happen naturally. And I kind of agree with Eric Voorhees when it comes to this conversation. We don't need people who are all philosophically oriented in the same direction that we are to embrace cryptocurrency, to move the dial forward toward greater freedom. Because ultimately, if people are using cryptocurrency, they're automatically still destabilizing the nation state to varying degrees. And this is something that I find really exciting, but let me explain why that's the case. Because cryptocurrency, the more people that use it, especially Bitcoin and some of the more popular cryptocurrencies, if they're trading their fiat currency, they're using a fiot rail like, say, CryptoSpace or any of these exchanges, they're putting their fiat currency out of circulation and usage, and they're attracting more cryptocurrency, and they're using that to trade with, and they're using that to exchange with, and they're holding that. That's where all their value is. And that naturally acts as a power vacuum away from the nation state. Now, I've always been of the mindset that this isn't going to be a transformation or a paradigm shift that's going to happen overnight. Even before I got into cryptocurrency, I knew that it was going to be a Herculean task to try to shift power away from the elites and into crypto. So this is going to be an ongoing power struggle and an ongoing battle. But I think ultimately crypto, we can't lose sight of the fact that cryptocurrency was still created largely by crypto anarchists and people who wanted to see power structures disintermediated by the nature of the way the protocol works. So regardless if people are in there chanting, oh, I want to see number go up, and they're talking about Moon and Lambo and being bag holders, at the end of the day, they're still working in an ecosystem that is fundamentally built to redistribute power away from the ruling class and into the hands of people who don't typically have that kind of power association. Whereas it is true that some of the elite have finally caught on and they realized, oh, I got to get into this space. I got to break in and I got to start buying up crypto in the hope that they're going to salvage their positioning and their power. But I think over time, the longer that crypto and Bitcoin exist and the more the society moves into the direction of a greater adoption, the more we're going to see the scales tip. And let me be very clear about why this is. There are a few features of Bitcoin that automatically undermine the nation state. And one is the issue of being able to print out as much money as you want. So these kleptocrats and bureaucrats and politicians, they typically can just press a red button and print out as much fiat currency as they want to fund endless wars, to hyperinflate the currency, which is basically soft theft from the population, to control people and to generate the revenue to wage an endless war on people called the drug war. That is impossible with cryptocurrency. And I know you want to get into this, Derek, but the system is fighting back. So they realize that they can't really control cryptocurrency per se. They can arrest a bunch of people, put a bunch of people in jail, which they have been doing, but they need more than that. So what they're going to attempt to do is create or mint their own digital assets, typically called CBDCs, in order to maintain control of the population. But the trick here is CBDCs are not going to be like Bitcoin as a cryptocurrency in the sense that they're still going to be able to control them. They're still going to be able to freeze and seize accounts, whereas you can't really do that in Bitcoin. So here's the key point. Bitcoin is censorship resistant, and not most cryptocurrencies, but not all, are also censorship resistant as well. So this is actually a really beautiful piece of the technology. So I'm still very, very optimistic about where we're moving with the technology in terms of changing the global paradigm. But I also am a realist in the sense that those who have power are extremely reluctant to give up that power. And sometimes they're going to fight tooth and nail and shed blood in order to maintain that power. But I really think that cryptocurrency as a technology has finally given us the ability to wage a war against the system that doesn't automatically involve bloodshed, right? It's effective. Using cryptocurrency is effectively like opting out of the system, even if you're not philosophically cognizant of what you're doing.
Yeah, a lot good said there and a lot to unpack. I'm going to hit a couple points, and I'm glad you brought into CBDCs. It kind of perfectly goes into where I think we should start getting into, which is some of those concerns. And the first thing I want to say is that I appreciate you sharing, you know, the optimistic and the realistic vision. You know, I hesitate to feel the same as far as the revolutionary aspect of crypto at this point, because I feel like holding crypto is not really enough. You know, like holding a crypto, I guess, you know, I get that it brings more people into that system, and maybe generationally, because that's the other point I agreed with. It's definitely a generational change. It's not going to happen overnight. You know, power is not going to let go easy, and it takes time to build new systems. But I feel like even just holding crypto, you know, if people, for one, a lot of people hold crypto and then they just try to make gains and sell it back for fiat, right? So they're still just going back in the Federal Reserve System. But then even on a deeper level than that, I think that, and we don't, you know, I don't know if we have time for, you know, getting too deep in this today, but I kind of feel like, for me, thinking in terms of a holistic anarchism, I do think also how that money is used, that crypto is used, is that crypto going to support, or is their use of blockchain and their use of crypto going to support freedom, or is it going to support other things, you know, in that context? And that kind of moves into the central bank digital currencies, right? Because some people see Bitcoin just as an investment. And so when CBDCs come out and they're an investment opportunity, hey, hold the government coin, you know, stake this or whatever, other people are going to maybe see that as a good investment too, you know, because they're not really thinking in terms of liberation. So they might not even truly get why something like Bitcoin or Monero or other privacy coins, why that privacy matters, why that decentralization matters, right? Because like I said, Miriam and I will get family members hit us up and say, you know, can you help me buy some Bitcoin? Can I buy it through my PayPal account or my Cash App or Robinhood? You know, the really mainstream things. They're not really interested in having conversation about the privacy, or, you know, maybe they would, but it's not really what's driving them, right? So if somebody says, hey, the government rolled out their own token now, and I hear it's a good investment, they might go ahead and invest in that. So yeah, I have some more, but what do you think about that, first of all?
Yeah, I think that one piece of this that has played a role in a lot of people's adoption of cryptocurrency, not everybody's, is education, right? I think a lot of people that are being involved in the cryptocurrency space now, especially folks that who have already been either scammed or had an issue with their currency on exchange, they've naturally gotten more educated on the technology, even if they started out as purely as a speculator or an investor and had no philosophical agenda. They've learned very quickly that they have to protect their coins, and they have to adopt a mindset toward financial responsibility. And because they've started to adopt this mindset, they're going to do more due diligence into the various cryptocurrencies that emerge. And looking into CBDCs, they're going to realize very quickly that this is not going to be a sound investment because of the nature of it. But don't let me make a misjudgment here or a mischaracterization of what you're saying, Derek. There's still going to be people, plenty of people, who jump on board at the wrong time, or maybe who are brand new in this and who haven't started researching, that are going to start grabbing up CBDCs. But here's a very interesting truth about what's going to happen. Those people are going to get into CBDCs, and maybe they are going to think it's going to be a good investment. But let's be honest, what fiat currency has been a good investment, right? Very few have been a good investment, other than for the individual who's lucky on FX trades, right, on foreign exchange. What happens is, though, people get burned on fiat all the time because governments constantly hyperinflate it. So once people start getting burned on that, they're going to realize, oh, maybe this wasn't such a good idea. They're going to get into other cryptocurrencies. But there is one good point to make here, and that's this also happens in the crypto space. So as people notice that, they start naturally educating and re-gearing themselves. And this is what's happened largely in the internet, too, as Web 1, Web 2, and Web 3 applications have developed. People continue to educate themselves, and then as they learn, they get involved on which layers of the web provide more sovereignty and more personal freedom. Won't happen for everyone, and it won't happen quickly, but it will happen as time progresses and we move into the future. But you know me, I'm kind of a stringent optimist.
Hey, well, that we need that, right? I appreciate that. So let's get into a little bit more of the mud, though, with some of the concerns, right? I have a few notes written here. We talked a little bit about CBDCs, but let's kind of elaborate on, we were talking sort of on the economic financial aspect. I think it's important to connect some of the fears of blockchain to some of the current issues that we're dealing with, current things, including vaccine passports, right? There's increasing push for vaccine passports around the world using things like QR codes. And specifically, there are some companies trying to develop these on blockchains. So what I see is that people see that use of blockchain and again, either assume, well, blockchain, that must mean all blockchain bad, which I think is a really kind of limiting perspective. And then the other thing I, other kind of claim I've heard, which I also don't agree with, is things like, well, even if Bitcoin is a different type of blockchain or Monero or whatever it is that you want to use, the fact that you're using blockchain is normalizing the use of this technology that we know these other people have plans to use in really bad ways. And so by you contributing to that, you know, you're contributing to the push towards the dystopian metaverse on the blockchain. Because when we talk about things being immutable and, you know, forever, people hear that in terms of government or the state trying to make use of blockchains, like, oh my God, like we could have a permanent record of whatever they want, right? And then we talk about tokenization and the different ways that tokenizing parts of life could be cool or useful or, you know, financially profitable or whatever. And people worry, well, what happens whenever you need a token to get water? You need a token to, you know, there's when things become tokenized everywhere and if it becomes enforced on people in a non-voluntary way. So I know that was kind of a mouthful there, but yeah, what do you think about these general concerns here?
Yeah, no, I think a lot of these are valid concerns because obviously the banks, governments are creating CBDCs. There are concerns that maybe a blockchain will be used to facilitate vaccine passports, but to say that these negate or somehow push aside the value and the good and positive use cases of blockchain is throwing the baby out with the bathwater. It's forgetting the original intent and use case of the technology. But listen here, this is some of this actually just goes beyond blockchain, right? And cryptocurrency. If governments start trying to enforce people to do something like get vaccine passports, it doesn't matter if they're leveraging a blockchain to do that or not, right? The fact is that there's a higher level of problem that's occurring, and that's violence of the state, and that's forcing people to get a vaccine, and they're simply just using a blockchain, which is just another kind of ledger to map out and to draw out and to keep track of all of that information. So I really think a big piece of this is we need to help continue to help educating people on the activist level and pushing back against government control and government violence. And that, I think that's a good part of what I want to say. The answer isn't just blockchain or cryptocurrency. And you know as well as I do, Derek, that hasn't always been my focus hasn't been cryptocurrency is the savior to all things. I still think there's an important part of education and learning that we have to disseminate on the population so people get the hint that government initiatives and forcing people to do things is not good, because really it doesn't matter if it's on a blockchain or not. If government's going to force people to do it, a lot of people are going to fall in line because they're fearful of what that authority is going to do to them, either put them in a cage or put them in the ground, right? And that's not a good thing. But suffice it to say, the good news is that because we can do good things with blockchain, those good things cannot be easily disrupted by governments. Yes, they can arrest people, they can put people in jail, and they've done that, but it hasn't stopped all of the good things that are happening as a result. So the government, regardless of blockchain exists or not, they're still going to do bad things and they're going to try to hurt people. But blockchain has given us a way to rise out from under our fetters, right? To escape our shackles and to figure out ways to work together that are more efficient. And the beautiful thing about this is I think it's naturally going to coalesce into new types of organizations, new types of ways that we relate to each other, new types of cities. And I think that we're entering a realm of greater experimentation that exists outside the scope of the state. And that's really happening right now in some of these smart cities. It's going to happen in terms of ideas like the Seasteading Institute and a lot of these different ideas. And I think it's absolutely beautiful. We can't discount the power of education. We also can't discount the fact that governments are going to come after us regardless. And because of blockchain, they're going to definitely try to push harder and they're going to try to co-opt the technology. But again, education, talking to people, it's all an important part of it. And blockchain technology is not magically going to stop people from pointing guns at others. Just the fact of the matter.
Yeah. And you said, you know, like you said, that when if that situation is happening, if we have the government trying to forcibly vaccinate people, then the bigger issue, the core issue, is violence being used against people. And maybe it could happen on a blockchain. There's definitely plans and talks of that. It's a fact. But if whether it happened on a blockchain or not, it seems like something we'd want to oppose either way. And then, you know, and so I feel that same way when I'm going to put two things on screen real quick. I hear this criticism as well, and I'm just going to show you. So we go to the World Economic Forum website, the people behind the Great Reset, this push for centralization, top-down control, technocrats, and you know they have lots of things about blockchain. So again, people, not that I trust the sort of front face these people put forward, but you know, because they talk all about sustainability, diversity, inclusivity, blah blah, whatever. But I don't really believe, you know, I think it's just the language they try to use to hide their technocratic agenda, which is, you know, top-down control. My point here is that, again, people will see things like this and say, hey, well, you know, blockchain, they're talking about it, so it must be bad. And I think you already answered that with it throwing the baby out with the bathwater, as far as, you know, having real concerns, because I'll also, you mentioned one of the things, smart cities. You can go to my website. Those who follow me regularly know that I've written articles and investigations about the dangers and the concerns of smart cities and blockchains. But I wanted to kind of touch on that because I know you mentioned it in that context as a potential positive. And I think that this is what people need to understand about this technology, is that we are in a digital arms race right now. This technology is not going to disappear overnight. If you hate it and you wish you could smash all the computers, if that's your thing, it's not going to happen. Like, and I'm not saying, you know, if you can't beat them, join them. But I am saying these tools are around. And if we had basically thrown up our hands and say, well, DARPA helped create the internet, which is a fact, I'm not going to participate in it, then none of us would have been able to reach people. We would have just given up the fight before it even got started. You know, that doesn't mean you need to embrace all these technologies, but some people will make use of them and do so in a positive manner. And this is what I'm seeing, is this digital arms race. It can lead to smart cities as digital prisons, like I wrote there in my my video report there, or it can lead to what people refer to as like private cities, the seasteading, things like that. Maybe you can elaborate a little bit on that, because people in my audience are going to hear you say smart cities in the context of something that might potentially be positive, and they're going to see the reports and the things I've done. I know what you're referring to. I know the potentials for good. I also clearly have concerns about the ways that smart cities can be an end of individual privacy and liberty and things of that sort. But talk about, you know, this vision of being able to create private cities or autonomous communities. And the next question after this, we can start making our way to talking about DAOs, decentralized autonomous organizations, and how those things might coalesce together.
Hold that thought. Guys, before we go any further, I want to tell you a little bit about a project that I recently launched called the Holistic Self-Assessment Online Course. Now, some of you know that I released this book, The Holistic Self-Assessment, in April 2018. And essentially, this book is the culmination of the experiences I had when I went to prison, dealing with addiction, dealing with depression, and suicide attempts. This is the process that I took myself through to get to know who I am, to get to know my principles, to get to align my relationships, my words, my thoughts, and actions with those principles. Overall, it's meant to be a self-empowerment, self-help guide that can help you start accomplishing your goals by aligning your principles with your actions. The book is available to download for free, and I'll include that link below. But if you're interested, I did recently launch a new online course, which you can find on the University of Reason, aka Autonomy. I partnered with them recently, and they created this whole online course for me. It's 9 weeks long. You can watch and follow along and read the book as I go through each chapter. I read it with you, and I offer some tips and some exercises. There are two different options. You can either do DIY, where you just go through the 9-week course yourself, or if you want to have personal one-on-one sessions with me, there's also an option for that. So check that out, guys. I'll include both links below. Let's get back to the podcast.
Yeah, I do want to address just an issue too. You mentioned before I get into that, this idea that the internet has been used by the government to do some pretty nasty things to us as individuals. I think PRISM is one of those. Operation PRISM, a greater surveillance state as conducted by the internet, or the internet as a conduit for greater surveillance. And even though that's happened, it hasn't stopped us from trying to leverage the internet to gain more anonymity and to do things that are outside the scope of the system. And we all know the story of Ross Ulbricht and what he tried to do with the Silk Road. And so here's the beautiful thing. none of us would have had access to encryption technology had it not been for crypto anarchists and cypherpunks, right? In the 1990s, there was actually a war between the crypto anarchists and various three-letter alphabet soup agencies of the government. And one of these things was they were trying to withhold very sensitive documents on cryptography and how it would how it could function. Well, the crypto anarchists effectively let that information out into the public. It was against the law, quote unquote, what they did. But because of their efforts, encryption technology got into the hands of the people, and that enabled us to leverage the internet more for our own end uses and to try to gain more privacy and anonymity against the state. So like you said, Derek, there is this digital arms race, but I think we're really starting to gain more momentum in terms of using the internet to gain greater access to neutrality, right? And to have more freedom and greater usability for the free person. Now, moving on to your question about smart cities and how we can leverage smart cities to free people rather than enslave them. I think one of the coolest things that's happening in the blockchain space and in the technology space is that a lot of what's happening is out of our hands, right? If anybody's familiar with Ray Kurzweil's work, he basically talked about this notion that we're moving toward a singularity, that technology is expanding at such a rapid rate that it's very difficult for us to keep track of what's happening. It's very difficult for us to keep our pulse on technological advancement. And at some point, AI technology is going to advance to the extent of becoming sentient. Now, that's kind of a bit of a side discussion, but the point here is governments and bureaucrats are extremely sclerotic. They're extremely handicapped. They're very slow about reacting and addressing technology as it grows up, right? They're just now really in the pilot stages of trying to put out these CBDCs. And guess what? We're already creating hedge funds on DeFi networks that are technically illegal, right? If you try to create a hedge fund on traditionally, you need $100 million in capital. You need all of this runway. You need to fight all of these regulations and all of this red tape, and you need to get all of these licenses. Well, guys have already did this. There's a decentralized app built on Aragon called Surf, or the Surf Network, where they have millions of dollars in crypto hedge assets that are gaining people capitalization all the time. And these are basically the nerds in grandmother's basement. Government has barely caught on to this. And they've arrested people and made examples of people, but they can't keep track of the pace of technological change. And that's one of the greater reasons, I think, why these innovations are changing the nature and the scope of society. And it's really impossible for us to game out all of the iterations, how this is going to play. But what it looks like is it's going to be untouchable by not only government, but a bunch of different people. It's kind of taking on a life of its own, and humans are just edging in on a symbiotic relationship with technology. And I think it's absolutely beautiful. And yeah, I'm going to give you a chance to comment, Derek. I know I really do want to get into more about DAOs and how they function. And I think you probably want to as well. But this is my sort of my general thrust of this conversation. Technology is outpacing government bureaucracy. That's a fact.
You know, I love our friendship because I definitely feel like we're very aligned on certain issues, especially anarchism and some of the potentials for technology. And I think you do tend to have more of an optimistic view than I do. And I appreciate that because it's good to hear every now and then. And, you know, I think maybe every now and then your optimism can be tempered by some of my fears of the other realities going on. But yeah, because I feel personally, I mean, first of all, as long as things are voluntary and consensual, of course, then people can do whatever. I mean, I accept that we are moving into a world now. I am not a transhumanist. I don't support transhumanism. As for me personally, I have a lot of concerns about this technocratic transhumanist vision, especially obviously when forced upon people. But I also believe in cognitive liberty. I believe in bodily autonomy. I know people are already starting to try to augment their bodies and do different things, and that's going to continue into the future. It's going to be the cypherpunk sci-fi future many of us have read about. So I have no desire to tell people, obviously as an anarchist, tell people what to do with their lives or what not to do. You know, I have my opinions and my views. So I want to make that clear that I don't think it's for me. I'm okay with living my normal human life with maybe the help of some, you know, developments. I don't want to live, you know, forever. I don't want to augment my body so that happens. I don't want to implant my consciousness. Like, these are things that I'm not interested in. But I also think that this is the world we are inevitably moving into when those opportunities will arise. So that's something I think, again, unless people want to take some sort of Ted Kaczynski stance that like we need to destroy all the technology, it's moving forward. Now you have choices, like always, of how you want to engage. There are people who don't have laptops and computers and cell phones and social media, and they live lives just fine, right? But many of us have chosen to be in that world. The metaverse is going to roll out, and some people will choose to participate in that. Some of us will say, heck no, we want to stay away from it. Others will try to do the same thing as they're trying to do with blockchain and crypto and create the cryptoverse. I've heard this idea of, you know, some decentralized versions, right? I mean, I think that's going to be up to everybody to decide how they, as always, how you approach and interact with technology. But the difference from technologies in the past is that these are becoming all-encompassing things that affect every aspect of our lives. So whether or not you're participating, it is going to be affecting the life, your life and the people around you, right? So it's a huge conversation, but I definitely truly do fear some of the things that are being created right now and erected. Like for me personally, things like hearing about retinal scanning on the Ethereum blockchain. Like there's, you know, companies involved in that. That's not something that I'm for personally. I don't use the iPhone, the face scan, but again, people do so voluntarily. They're consensually doing that. That's up to them. I wouldn't trust Apple with my face print. I wouldn't trust these people. But if you do so in a way that's, you know, you're reclaiming your ownership and don't know, you know, I think there's ways to go about it that might make sense for some people. So yeah, I mean, I just appreciate the nuance and the diversity of opinions here on this topic, man. I do want to get into DAOs, but is there anything else you want to say just on that generally? We've kind of covered a lot of different criticisms at this point now.
Yeah, I do want to say, I know a lot of the big fears, and I think it's some of your fears as well, and it's definitely mine, Derek, is that big tech has been an issue, right? We know of Facebook's issues with basically yanking customer data and selling it to companies like Cambridge Analytica. Everybody, a lot of people know about Brittany Kaiser and her as a whistleblower for Cambridge Analytica and how effectively Facebook leveraged data to impact the Trump election. And that was a huge deal, right? Because it was not necessarily, I think, the intended use case for data's use case for a lot of the people who are using the technology. We know that Google has been leveraging different kinds of algorithms to control the output of content on their different aspects of their technology. Specifically, sometimes they'll even block or negate Word docs because of the content that's in those. I've heard that happening to people. But the beautiful thing is that that's just part of Web 2 applications. Web 2 applications, this idea that anybody can get on the internet and they can use their share of voice to get their ideas out there, or they could build certain tools while leveraging a company and grow that. So that's the Amazons, the Facebooks, the Googles of the world. But now we're moving into a different ecosystem within the internet, another layer, which is called Web 3. And Web 3 is this idea that we're creating decentralized autonomous organizations or decentralized applications that are effectively software programs that provide the same kind of services or functions that these old companies did, these big tech companies. And now that we can use these and they're more credibly neutral than these larger companies. In other words, they're more fair. They don't necessarily discriminate or censor individuals. Instead, anybody can be involved and leverage them depending on how the protocol has been developed. And it's very much going to fracture into a multitude of different tools and use cases so that it's just not one ring to rule them all, right? In the case of these large tech giants, we're moving away from that and we're going to move into a more fair and equitable playing ground on the internet. So I can see very clearly, because of the nature of how these systems are ironing themselves out, that the big giant tech corporations are going to end up being a thing of the past. And there's plenty of evidence we could cite for that too moving forward. So we're going to get more into this.
Yeah, so let's go ahead and I want to just wrap up some of the criticisms, the questions around that, with just kind of saying to those who are listening, this conversation isn't meant to convince anybody to adapt crypto if you're not into it. It's I'm just trying to make sure we're covering our bases, because I know you'll be in the comments making sure, but what about this? What about this thing, Derek? So I want to make sure we do address the realistic concerns, but it's not an attempt to convince anybody. If you're not interested in crypto and blockchain, then you're free to stay out of the space. And for those who are interested, hopefully this gives you some more background. But I think a lot of the concerns, or, besides the specifics about projects and this and that, but just the general fear about the technology and different types of technologies, and the refusal to see them as tools. This is one thing I've seen as well, saying, no, it's not just a tool. It's, bad. That it just comes down to whether or not you believe that any new development is going to be used against us, because that's what I keep seeing is like, okay, well, here's this potential positive thing. No, they're going to use it for bad, so I don't want to participate. No, they're going to do this for, and if that's your path, then I think there's probably nothing to convince you that there's anything good on the horizon, if that's the, the path that you want to see. But I think Sterling and I, and maybe others out there, are choosing to take a realistic but optimistic viewpoint of the direction that humanity is headed. Despite the evidence around us, I do think that more and more people are waking up and asking questions and looking for solutions. And that's a beautiful thing. One of these potential solutions are DAOs. And of course, I will add the caveat that with this as well, there are people who are concerned DAOs can be used. We put in governance systems, like we're going to show Aragon on the screen in just a moment, but we put in governance systems. Well, now it's not even a human. It's just a blockchain. That's cold. It's heartless. It's emotionless, right? What happens if you get starved out of the system because the blockchain said so, right? Think, there's those concerns with DAOs. Maybe we can get into that as well, but let's generally just get into, we'll talk about Aragon, but more generally, what is a decentralized autonomous organization? You were kind of explaining it could be used for, could this be used for somebody's activist group, somebody's business, somebody's family, community? What are the ways this could be used?
Yeah, so a DAO can be used for a number of things anywhere, but it could be a business, it could be a charitable organization, it could be a membership opportunity. So there's a number of things a DAO can be used for. And a DAO defined, so it's a decentralized autonomous organization. Decentralized means, as I pointed out earlier, it's a distributed network of computers. Autonomous means simply that it's self-governing. An organization just means that it's a group of people or a community working toward a common goal, right? And there's really four primary concepts surrounding a DAO that everyone needs to be familiar of. And the first one is infrastructure. So a DAO is created on top of a blockchain. And one of the more important blockchains, or the more prominent blockchains involved in this, has been Ethereum, as I mentioned earlier. And Ethereum gives us the ability to create organizations that are permissionless, that are borderless, and that have an equitable playing field for people to get involved in not only using them, but also creating their networks. So another concept is also the concept of payments, right? On the Ethereum network, we can leverage various kinds of ways to pay each other. And typically that's either with Ethereum or it's with what we call an ERC-20 token. An ERC-20 token is just a smart contract token that performs some type of utility or other function on a blockchain, right? So these payment systems allow us to create unique use cases via a DAO. And let me just to give you an example, so I'm not completely abstract. There's such a thing as a prediction market. A prediction market is basically a market where we would use a token to vote on a future event. And predictions markets leverage what's called wisdom of the crowds to take a guess about what's going to happen in the future. And it's been shown that wisdom of the crowds has a tendency to be more accurate than just a small group of guys taking a guess about what's going to happen in the future, socially, economically, spiritually, societally, doesn't matter. Wisdom of the crowds is a more accurate judge or accurate bet about what's going to happen in the future. And we can use ERC-20 tokens to effectively power the engines of these prediction markets. And this is an absolutely amazing thing. Another piece of a decentralized autonomous organization, another concept, is the workforce. So in a traditional company organization, the talent pool of that workforce is very constrained, very small. Typically, it's localized. But in a decentralized autonomous network, the the diversity of the workforce is much larger because people all over the world can join a decentralized autonomous organization and they can write up proposals and they can contribute to the growth and development of that community. So the workforce is more diversified. There's less discrimination and there's more openness in terms of the way that people work with that DAO and the way they manipulate the internal mechanisms. The last part of this, but the most important concept behind a DAO is this notion of governance. So in traditional organizations, they are governed hierarchically, meaning that there's someone at the top of a pyramid, and this is like the CEO or the president, and they're running the organization from the top down. But what happens in these type of organizations is that the development and the blossoming of ideas is stifled because if someone on the ground floor has a brilliant idea on how to move the company forward, because of all the red tape and all the bureaucracy and the lack of concern for the people on the bottom, a lot of times those ideas don't come to fruition because the people at the top who are the decision makers don't have that opportunity. Now, decentralized autonomous organizations oftentimes take a flat governance structure where everybody has an equitable say in what happens within the company. They can make votes, decentralized votes in the system, and then people can actually make joint decisions on where the organization goes. So this creates two things, and these are the ideas that I want you guys to remember. It creates an idea meritocracy. And under an idea meritocracy, ideas are free flowing and they're way more accessible. So this makes the decentralized autonomous organization more adroit, more fleet of foot, and more able to move and change based on the changing market conditions that the DAO finds itself in. And the last one I already mentioned is also wisdom of the crowds. So the more people that are voting on an equitable playing field, it really means that if they've decided unanimously on an idea, then that idea is probably what needs to happen within the context, within the governance context of that organization. So in so many ways, these decentralized autonomous organizations are way more flexible and way more bendable in some ways or elastic than the traditional organization. And this is why DAOs are already passing up a lot of the traditional financial organizations. I mentioned earlier the hedge fund. There's an article on Aragon that all you guys should read called something like starting a hedge fund from your bedroom, right? And there's also one starting a charity from your bedroom. And you can do this literally from your bedroom without needing to go into license, regulations, et cetera. But with a word of caution, that it is very possible that if you do get involved in this space, you could be beholden to rules of the government that you have to follow, or you could go to jail. It doesn't mean you can do this and necessarily get away with it. But the facts are that people are creating these things and they're not abiding by any regulations or anything anyway. And it's happening right now. Yes, some people have gone to jail, but there's so many of these things proliferating that it's probably impossible for bureaucrats to keep track of everything that's happening. And this goes back to one of my primary points, I think, or overarching points of this conversation, is that technology is moving at such a fast pace and things are changing so rapidly that controllers, central planners, and these folks who want to make sure that everything goes the way that they want it to go, it's just not happening. They just can't keep up, right? So it's an absolutely awesome thing. One more point I want to mention about decentralized autonomous organizations. Decision-making in traditional companies or even government it's slow, it's bloated, and it's often only made by those at the very top of the hierarchy. So decentralized autonomous organizations or distributed cooperatives leverage what we call choice architecture. Choice architecture is this notion that the infrastructure is built around the notion that we get to choose, and we're not deferring those choices to people with authority because we're too lazy or we're too scared, but instead we're getting to involve ourselves in the momentum and in the forward thrust of how these organizations function. So this has been one of my passions recently, is just looking at how the autonomy of DAOs actually work and how people are involving themselves in these organizations. And it's a really beautiful thing. And right now, even on Aragon's DAO stack, the tools are available to completely supplant governments, right? And to supplant traditional corporations and organizations. And it's happening right now. This isn't something, see, this is one of the things people don't, they're ignorant that this is actually happening, but it is right now, right? People are building these organizations and it's occurring outside the scope of the traditional sectors. And it's especially disruptive in the financial sector. And you can't ignore it. You have to pay attention to it. DAOs are amazing. This is the huge trend of the future. This is an opening up of Pandora's box, or as my friend Max Borders said, this is the djinn having escaped the lamp. Can't hear you, Derek. I think audio issue. There it goes.
Yeah, I like the way you put that. I appreciate that explanation there. And I hope that folks who are new to the DAO concept, or maybe have heard negative things or only the concerns of people, will go back and re-listen to that a couple times and definitely check out Aragon. I mean, neither one of us, I'm not involved in the project. I don't know if you are. I don't think you are, but I've heard about it. I've heard about Aragon, and there's other DAOs, of course. And you did give a few examples already, but one last thing I'll ask about DAOs is, what would you say to somebody who is open to blockchain and maybe a little skeptical, but they're interested in this and they want to understand, okay, well, what's the benefit of me putting my group, my business, my organization onto a DAO, creating a DAO and doing it through that, as opposed to doing it through some traditional means, like, whatever that might mean for them.
Yeah, I think the biggest issue, and you're right, I hinted at this, the biggest issue, say you want to start a financial institution, some kind of a cryptocurrency exchange like Uniswap, that's a DeFi DAO, or a hedge fund like Surf, is the barriers to entry are completely insane. I said earlier, you got to have millions of dollars in capital, you got to have surety bonds, you have to have a track record and experience of managing funds. And that's not to say that some of these things aren't bad. There's really legitimate reasons why we have to have some type of understanding to protect our customers. But the beautiful thing about getting involved in a DAO, you can do this without having to have all of those prerequisites. But the protocol and the algorithms are actually built and developed in such a way to help protect the users, right? And let me be very candid here. This is not to say that these things are perfect. There's been a lot of problems with smart contracts. The technology is still new. Some of them have broken. People have lost money. So I want to be clear that this isn't a utopian vision. This is still very much an experiment. But the technology, this is, as technology typically is, it's maturing and it's getting better and it's evolving. And as it evolves, the technology gets more solid and more available for use. So the main reason is you get involved in this technology because it has way less barriers to entry. You can start it with a little bit of Ethereum, and you can, if you want to make more money off of it, if that's your interest, you could start the DAO in a way that is first more centralized, and you can move it to decentralized. So they're very flexible. But if you're just wanting to, if you're more ideological bent like me, and you want to just start something to move outside the scope of traditional finance, you can do that. You can make your system more flat and you can get more people involved, and you can create a bunch of tools and a bunch of applications on top of it that meet whatever goal or agenda you have. And let me be clear too. I'm an anarchist, typically have the voluntarist bent, but I think a lot of people on the left have even more skepticism of crypto and blockchain. But these tools actually enable them to create cooperatives, mutual aid societies, and ways to work together that create more equilibrium between the workforce than in the traditional model. So this stuff is going to very much appeal to you guys as well. But the beauty of blockchain technology, and this is something I want to leave you guys with, is that it's opt-in, it's voluntary, right? If you don't like a technology, or if you think it's a scam or a pyramid scheme or rug pull, which a lot have been, then you actually don't have to be involved in that, right? So the onus is on you to educate yourself and to have that acumen to know the wheat from the chaff, basically, to know what the good projects are from the bad. So you have to pick and choose and opt in to use those platforms. One that I recommend, and this isn't financial advice or business advice, but I really like Aragon because it's cool. It's easy to use. The stack is all built up, and a lot of people have already built companies on top of it, right? Built DAOs on top of it. So,
Yeah, I definitely am really curious to learn more about Aragon. I mean, it's not the first DAO that I've come across, but it does seem to be very well put together. And I'm curious about it. DAOs in different contexts. Like I've seen folks out here in Mexico who are looking for land and intentional communities who might want to organize their community and have some of their governance and their structure done through a DAO, right? So there could be a record of it and it can have all the different features you were just discussing. And I think that could be interesting. It could be cool. I also, again, wonder, I'm like, okay, well, I wonder at what point it might feel necessary, right? Because maybe if you have a small group of people and you're living right by each other, you know, you can just make decisions easier on your own. You don't really need to bring in that system, but maybe there will be other times where it could be valuable. So I'm excited. I'm excited to see where some of that goes. I'm also, as I said earlier, terrified with a lot of some of the other potentials, but really I think that we've been at this point for a while, but it's becoming more and more clear that we are at a point where this is the digital arms race. This is the battle of good technology versus bad technology. Well, technology used for good and bad, I'll say. That's been going on forever. But as far as digital technology is increasingly happening right now. And I think it's just that more and more people are becoming aware of that. And so they are increasingly skeptical of different digital tools. But again, I think it's just up to each person. As I mentioned a moment ago about being aware that there are people in the crypto space who have a freedom mindset, who believe that they can create, you know, some virtual world, metaverse type projects that will be about individual liberty and privacy and decentralization and these kinds of things. And then, of course, you got the Facebooks of the world wanting to create their version of that, right? And maybe people's choices, they don't want to be involved in the metaverse at all. They don't want virtual reality, augmented reality. They're cool with, you know, just reality. And others will say, hey, I do want to experiment in that, but I'm going to choose this decentralverse over Facebook's metaverse or whatever the case may be. Those are, again, choices people will have to make. I think people are already making those choices right now. If you really think about it, many of us have stopped using YouTube, Google, you know, for search and these kind of platforms that are using Odyssey. We're using Rockfin. We're using decentralized platforms, which happen to be on blockchains as well, because there's value in them, right? So I just think that ultimately people need to make their decisions. And I want to wrap up here, Sterling, by mentioning that if you enjoy this conversation, for one, look forward to seeing Sterling at the Greater Reset. He is speaking at the event on what day do we have you on? On Agorism and Parallel Network. So that'll be... Yep. Thursday, January 27th, and we're actually posting the schedule this weekend, so you'll be able to see when Sterling's speaking. You can come here, read a little more about his bio, and if you click here, this actually will take you to a link for Sterling's book. And let's talk about this for a moment, Sterling, before we wrap up. We didn't really touch on this yet, but as I mentioned earlier, our previous conversation in 2016 was more focused on anarchism and compassionate anarchism, all the work that you've done in that field over the years. So let's talk a little bit about that if you'd like.
Yeah, sure. No problem. Yeah, this is the book is a really collected works. It's a work that I've put together over the past 10 years. And I think that one of the more interesting parts, or at least the parts that I think are more interesting, is my contribution to the anarchist movement is this idea of relational anarchism. And this is part two in the book. And the crux of the idea is that if we work together in our communities and work together by learning to empathize with each other, by leveraging nonviolent communication, as Marshall Rosenberg said, gaining access to each other's needs and understanding those needs, then that's actually the impetus toward building freer societies, right? Because empathy is antithetical to aggression. You can't be empathetic and also violent, right? You can't be ugly and mean and also good. At least it's very difficult to do that. So the more empathy that we're leveraging, the more that we're trying to understand people, we're actually building freer communities without having to resort to the nastiness and brutishness of not only violence, but also the argumentation philosophy. And I think there's a time and place, and I do it all the time as well, to debate different topics and different ideas. But if we're unwilling to access other people's needs and to try to find common ground, then we're actually just going to be missing an opportunity to grow freer communities and freer enclaves. And it is true that the larger the communities get, the larger the groups get, the more difficult it is to maintain these groups. So I wrote a three-part series back in, I guess it was like 2017, 2018, on relational anarchism. And I broke down all of my thoughts on these ideas and put them in there. And it was the first part basically explored my own growth as an anarchism, this idea that I have to be rational and logical to the extent of dropping or withdrawing from emotional life. And I finally realized that that's wrong. And in order to build for your societies and to build a better self, we have to learn to connect with others. So I really draw out this whole process. I come up with a whole paradigm for thinking and for interacting with other people. And it's a paradigm that's really outside the scope of philosophy in the sense that it's totally interactive, that it's interpersonal, and that it's based on not only the content of our interactions, but the context of our interactions. So I really recommend the first part of the book is on typical anarchism. It's some of the basic ideas. There's a few unique pieces there, but part two is called Relational Anarchism and Therapeutic Liberation. And it's all about relational anarchism. It's also about cognitive liberty. And then part three, I thought this was important to include because I started talking about cryptocurrency and Bitcoin and how it's going to play into all of these aspects very early on back in 2013, 2014. And all of those initial ideas on cryptocurrency and Bitcoin are in part three of the book. So I really recommend you guys pick it up if it interests you.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll put a link directly to that in the show notes. You know, I actually want have one more question because I just listening to and recounting the work that you've done in that area, I feel like I would be remiss to not get your opinion on another topic of controversy recently, which relates to children, which is something children and the treatment of children, specifically things like spanking, which is, I know, a topic you've talked a whole lot about, and just the way society treats kids, you know, how that relates to the authoritarianism that we learn from governments and government schools, all the different ways that we're impacted by that, right? I know that you, somebody who do truly value, as do I, freeing the kids in different ways. And so one of the recent criticisms that I've come under related to the blockchain crypto conversation does intersect with the topic around kids. And it was a comment that I made in my previous episode with Catherine Austin Fitz related to saying perhaps kids in countries, I mentioned Mexico, but you could say anywhere where there's poverty or somebody in need could play video games or learn encryption or just learn how to, you know, deal in crypto and make themselves some extra money and help out their families. And how I see that, whether you like that or like crypto or blockchain, that appears to be an objective good. You know, you don't have to like the means, but if they can empower themselves, that should be seen as a good. And this was spun out to me supporting what has been referred to as digital child labor. And specifically, and that's an extreme way to put kids playing games, but specifically the people taking offense to the idea of games like Splinterlands, which are on blockchains. And, you know, they're like Magic the Gathering kind of card play, online digital card games, which have been around before blockchains. And kids have been making money off video games before blockchains. But anyways, I just, you know, it. What I think is at the root and the crux of this, the words of mine that have been now spun out to make me seem like some bad guy, include statements that I've made that children are sovereign and that children own themselves. That doesn't mean that you as a parent, you know, have no say and the state owns your kid or something like that, or the community owns your kid. I don't think the state owns your kid. I don't think the community owns your kid. And I don't think your kid's your property either. I say this, of course, I'm not a parent, but I know plenty of parents who have raised their kids with this mentality and this philosophy as well. And so, yeah, I just wanted to get your thoughts on that, because for one, I've just been baffled by people who seem to think that's a controversial statement to say that like kids are sovereign. What they're trying to spin it out is I'm saying, oh, so that means a kid's sovereign and they don't need any guardianship or anybody to look after them. So then they can make their own decisions and start playing games on the blockchain and be coding the future dystopian metaverse. I'm not trying to dismiss anybody's concerns, but it wasn't what I was saying at all. But just your thoughts on this idea though, because I use it as an opportunity to talk about my thoughts on I think kids should work if they want to, if they feel the need to or the desire to, or if their family needs to. I started working in sixth grade by choice. Here in Mexico, there are kids with families that are on the streets. In some cases, there is poverty, just like many places in the world. And some of those kids are out there walking out with their hands out, begging for change, or their mom's holding them on their shoulders while they juggle balls and then walk around trying to get change, or they try to wash windows. And this is in the middle of traffic. You know, I don't know if people would prefer that as opposed to them being at their home or a cyber cafe playing a video game for a couple hours and making more money than they would doing that. It was just one suggestion. My point is, I don't have a problem with kids choosing to work if it's, you know, something they want to do or if it's in the family. That doesn't mean I support forcing kids to work. I definitely don't support any of these nasty things. But what do you think about this? People who think it's a controversial statement to say that kids own themselves or that, you know, they shouldn't be treated as property.
Yeah, no, I agree with you 100%. I think that children should absolutely be considered sovereign. I think that one of the main concerns that people have when we say that, and this is the key term, is that child exploitation is going to be an issue. But let me, I guess, alleviate any kind of concerns or fears. I think that when you and I talk about child sovereignty, it just means that children should be seen as autonomous to the extent that trying to leverage force against them or hitting them or spanking them is not acceptable or not permissible from a moral standpoint. So what this means by the same token is that child labor looked at from the context of exploitation make a bit more sense, because if we try to exploit a child into working, that might be considered a violation of that. However, what's happening, and this is probably more true of the Industrial Revolution when kids were put in the chimney stacks and those kind of things, and maybe there's room to debate the merits or demerits of that. But what's happening today, and I agree with you definitely here, Derek, is that, I just read a story about a 12-year-old kid who created an NFT piece of art and multiple pieces of art that have sold over millions of dollars. So to say that this child is engaging in digital labor to enrich himself is absolutely ludicrous to me, right? I wish I was 12-year-old and minting an NFT and enriching myself and making sure that my future is secured. So this isn't digital labor. This is, to me, this is a child enjoying a hobby, experimenting with their future career, learning how to live life in modernity, learning how to push themselves forward. So this isn't any type of digital labor or exploitation. This is a child experimenting with their likes and being completely and totally sovereign. And I find it to be a beautiful thing. And the way that your quotes were either misquoted or taken out of context completely baffles the mind, because at the end of the day, children absolutely are sovereign. And it's the idea that children aren't free or that they're the property of children that has led to some of the most heinous situations in the world. You know, there's a really good book that I recommend by Alice Miller called For Your Own Good. And this portrait she paints in her book is that kids who are not only beat, but also have their emotions culled and suppressed within them, causes them massive trauma throughout life and actually causes them to be more aggressive and more resentful and to have things like substance abuse problems. She painted a caricature or a portrait of Hitler. Hitler grew up in an abusive family, and really that time in Weimar Germany, most people grew up in authoritarian regimented households, and they were forced to live under an authoritarian rule, and they almost always got the belt for disobedience. And it was really this environment of totalitarian parental control that was echoed in the state and how it regimented the army and how it was all based on hierarchical violence, or what we call a dominance hierarchy. And this is what causes states to manifest like this. And it's also why we find the symbolism of the paternalistic government, right? It's why people often refer to governments with familial language, right? Like Uncle Sam, the fatherland, the motherland. All of these symbols they echo or mirror the trauma that we experience in childhood at the hands of our own family. So if people are actually arguing that children should not be sovereign or autonomous, they're actually making the case that children should be controlled, manipulated. And it's ironically these people who are more likely to put children into bondage or into some kind of labor. These are the people who are telling their children to do all of these chores and to force them to into certain kinds of activities they want to do, like maybe playing football for the local team. So I think a lot of these people probably need to check themselves in their own ideas about children before, you know, drawing a line in the sand and saying this is what Derek's doing or this is what anybody else is doing by saying children should be sovereign. It really, what they're doing is they're twisting around the paradigm, and they're trying to throw it back at us. And a lot of that's based in guilt, I think.
Yeah, I appreciate your comment on that, man. It just came to mind right as we're wrapping up here, and I know you have a lot to say. So thank you for adding that. That's where we're going to end it today, guys. We've been talking with Sterling Lujan, and we're going to have all the references from our previous interview, where to get his book and his bio for the Greater Reset, in the show notes. And I really appreciate you taking the time, brother, to get into some of this. I know you love talking about crypto, and I know that For me personally, I've seen a blind spot in some in the crypto pro crypto community and some in the anti crypto community. You know, some who think it's all bad, maybe some who only see, you know, the good things. And I think it's important to have that discussion about the gray area, the nuance, and really see what we can come up with. So hopefully it's been informative to everybody listening. Any closing thoughts or, you know, where people can find your work?
Yeah, you can find all my stuff at sterlinlujan.com. And if you're interested in actually purchasing crypto and getting into it, our company can help you out. And that's cryptospace.com. And you can also find me on Facebook at Sterlin Lujan. And I'm on a variety of other social media platforms. It's always just by my name, Sterlin Lujan.
Great. We'll add those to the show notes. All right. It's been a great conversation. I hope all of you learned something. And this is probably going to be one you're going to want to listen to a couple of times to really take it all in. And if you hadn't listened to my previous conversation with Catherine Austin Fitz and some of the references didn't make sense, I encourage you to go listen to that one as well and make up your own mind. We'd love to hear your thoughts. And until next time, guys, remember, you are powerful, you are beautiful, and you are free. Peace.
Thank you for listening to the Activation Podcast, brought to you by the Conscious Resistance Network. You can find the archives of our show on Spotify, Pinecast, and at theconsciousresistance.com. Thanks for listening.